You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
We welcome Emma Seppala back to the podcast. Emma is a lecturer at Yale, where she also teaches executives at the Yale School of Management, and she is the faculty director of the Yale School of Management's Women's Leadership Program. We spoke to her previously about her book, The Happiness Track, and today we talk about her new book. It's called Sovereign: Reclaim Your Freedom, Energy, and Power in a Time of Distraction, Uncertainty, and Chaos. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Emma Seppala, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kelly. It's great to be here.
There's a line you wrote about a third of the way through the book, and this often happens to me when I'm trying to think of my first question. I always have like a post-it note or something there. I'm like, oh, I want to start with this one.
Uh-huh.
And the line you wrote is you write, quote, "Consider this, your smartphone is mostly just other people's agenda for you," end quote. Let's start there, I think, because I agree, but talk more. How is this the case? Because I think for most people, they're like, oh, my smartphone, I'm in control of this thing.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I wrote this book on sovereignty. It's that, you know, without even realizing it, we get bound to things and other people's agendas without even realizing it, thinking that we're in control and then wondering why we feel burnt out or why we're suddenly thinking and doing things we don't actually want to be doing. If you look at your cell phone and let's say you're scrolling through your social media, maybe there's a couple things you're interested in, but there's a lot of ads that are popping up right there where you want to be seeing other people's stuff. Your email, your inbox is filled with other people's requests for you. You know, hopefully you'll enjoy a couple of those. But I think we all know how we feel at this point about email. And so our text messages often as well. I mean, phones are essential. They're a tool that we really need, but if we are not aware, we can fall prey to being hooked into all kinds of things on our phone rather than living the life we want to be living in the present moment, you know, as well as, to give a personal example, I've been more active on social media as I'm promoting the messages from my new book. I toyed with the idea of doing opening a TikTok account. And as I opened one, just to kind of see, and I felt assailed mm-hmm. by the content coming at me. It felt like an assault. And now I know that some people, especially teenagers, are used to that. And they're probably scrolling TikTok while doing multiple other screens. But when you think about it, all of that information, and as psychologists, we know that you pick up everything, even if it's flashed in front of your eyes for a microsecond and you're not aware that you picked it up. It's influencing your mood. It's influencing your thoughts. It's influencing how your brain is reacting. And you can think of it as conditioning is happening to your brain involuntarily. And, you know, with this idea of sovereignty, I'm inviting people to reclaim the reins on your life. So you're actually living the life that you want to be living, because 70% of people on their deathbed felt like they didn't live the life they wanted, didn't make the choices they wanted, didn't tell the people they loved that they loved them. I mean, and nowadays, with so much of technology that is distracting us from our lives, how many of us are living the life we want?
I know there's studies around people on their deathbed, and it's, you know, they're not going to say, "I wish I worked more." They're also not going to say, "I wish I was on social media more."
Right.
I mean, I think that's pretty Garrett, and I think that goes for even kids who are on social media. They probably know this intellectually, but like you say, as human beings, we're very prone to these things. I joined TikTok and then I just removed it from my phone, and I can't add to it, because the other problem I've got is there's so many different ways that people message me now. It's maybe 9 or 10, I think, last time I counted it up, and that doesn't count like, you know, seeing me in a hallway. But that's too much to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And, you know, when you think about this research study that came out of the University of San Diego, looking at how much information we take in every day, it's 60,000 gigabytes of information per day, which is enough to crash a small computer in a week. And this data is old. This data I collected 6 years ago. I didn't collect myself, but I talked to the researcher, and it had already doubled from 5 years prior. So I don't even want to know what it is right now. But with all of that in our mind space, how much of us are seeing clearly, thinking clearly, and able to be present also with this life that's happening right here, right now?
So the book is called Sovereign: Reclaim Your Freedom, Energy, and Power in a Time of Distraction, Uncertainty, and Chaos. Have you been, like, is this a word? Is this, I mean, I know people in your field, and the words are so important. Mm-hmm. So is sovereign something that you've been playing with, or did it dawn on you one day? How do you come to this word?
Well, I didn't find a word in psychology to encapsulate this notion that I'm trying to suggest. As you know, I study the science of happiness, well-being, did research with trauma, anxiety, and so forth, and looking at ways to improve resilience. And we know there's so much data now in positive psychology, the science of happiness. But I did not find a term to encapsulate not just this idea of happiness and well-being, but living a life that's really true to yourself, in which you're honoring yourself and you're able to show up as your best potential. Because even for me, I felt like, okay, I'm meditating, I'm doing my breathing, I'm going in nature, I'm doing all the things. And yet I was, I had issues with my physical health, and I noticed that I was falling. I could see myself falling for notions and ideas that I realized these are not serving me. Like being in this high achieving sort of environment that I've always been in, at Yale, at Stanford, and just seeing how everyone is so driven to prove their own significance in the world. And as they're doing that, burning themselves out, self-loathing, if you will, right? I am what I do, and I'm only as valuable as I perform, and the amount of misery that I saw, no matter how successful someone was, and misery they were causing around them, to the people they work with, and to their own families. And it was like, wow, this is such an interesting paradigm that is driving a lot of high achievers. And there's no amount of attention or success that will mend that hole in your heart that comes from a lack of friendship from yourself. You know? And those are some, that was, for example, one idea, one notion that came to me. I opened my eyes like, wait a second. If we're being driven by programs that and conditioning and false beliefs, we are not living the life that we want. We're not living a happy life, and we're not living in the best and fullest expression of ourselves and able to show up in the best expression of ourselves.
And so I'm guessing too, because of that, because this particular word you found and the idea behind it, also is probably why you included so many stories of yourself, and not necessarily, I mean, like, I think you even say something like whether your husband was going to be excited about this or not. All that stuff comes up. And one of the things I love about that, because I talk about this when I give talks all the time, which is comedians know, especially stand-ups, in their, if you think about their first, you know, 5 minutes of their act, when you first get them, they are telling on themselves. So John Mulaney's a drunk. Amy Schumer's a slut, Patton Oswalt's a schlub. And in part, they do that because they want to draw that connection with the audience, and the audience is not interested in all your diplomas. They want your fiascos. That's how we connect. And then I think you take the power from the fiasco a little bit by owning it and talking about it.
And, you know, we're all just humans stumbling along, making mistakes, living and learning and hurting, and you know, that's what we're up to over here. I'm not going to pretend I'm anything other than that. Who cares if I'm, you know, teaching at Yale and doing research? How much use is that if I can't apply it to my life and help others with it? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So plus, then, I kind of wanted to make people laugh every now and then.
Yeah, no, I love that. So let's talk about, you had to give a keynote, and this is, I think this is COVID time, so you were doing it from home, but it was on a Saturday, which is not, I don't know that I've ever delivered a Saturday keynote. You probably haven't, unless it was like you were on site somewhere. So what happened?
Well, my husband wasn't feeling that great that morning, and I took the kids to a park an hour from our house, and I get a text message that says, "Are you having trouble logging on?"
Oh, no.
And I tell you, I had planned this for 6 months with this particular conference, and I felt full body shame. I felt full body shame. And yet, you know, having studied this program that runs in so many people's minds of self-criticism, which psychology actually defines as self-loathing, uh-huh. And 90 to 95% of audience where I ask who's here is self-critical will raise their hand. And if you look at it from a psychological perspective, it's self-loathing. And how many people, when they make a mistake, beat themselves up, are their worst critic? You know, and they would never use those kinds of words for their child or their friend or even a stranger, right? So I knew about that research and how it, and that program. I call it a program because it's conditioning that you've received either in your family or in your society, in our culture, everybody's doing it, right? So in that moment, you know, what the research shows is, yeah, feel the feelings. But don't go into a further spiral. And I tell you what, I felt that shame for 3-4 hours of devastating shame. And I went home. But I went home. I, you know, taped a new talk, sent it to them, told them to cancel my honorarium, you know, all the things. But I didn't take it further. I didn't beat myself up. You know, isn't the shame punishment enough? And I knew that would not help me show up for anyone else or for anyone around me, with that sort of inner terrorism, I call it inner terrorism, because research shows that when you have this sort of self-loathing, self-critical approach to yourself, it actually activates your sympathetic nervous system, your fight or flight response. It's like we're our own perpetrator.
For myself, certainly been in similar situations. One of the things I like about getting older, and there's not many things, but this is one of them. I beat up myself less.
I love that.
And I don't know if it's age alone, if it's research and actualizing it, or if it's that sort of that the exercise of how many days do I have left, and how many, you know, you know, thinking about how many times am I going to be able to walk my dog, you know, again, yes. You know, before he passes, how many conversations am I going to be able to have with my son? When you start thinking in those terms, then this stuff becomes small, but it takes work to not feel that way, because that initial sort of shame thing is too strong to say it's not going to be there. But the lingering is the issue.
The lingering, because it keeps your mistake front and center when it's long behind you at this point. You know, not that we shouldn't learn from our mistakes. We should, you know, next time I have a Saturday keynote, I have like an alarm the night before, the morning of, all the things. But like you said, all of our time is limited. We have no idea how long any of us have left. How are we going to live that life? How are we going to show up for people? You know, how are we going to show up for ourselves?
So you teach exec ed. And mm-hmm. I think for many people, because the people who are taking exec ed at Yale are probably pretty accomplished, they're C-suite folk. But you say this same sort of stuff shows up with these folks.
Yes. And in fact, I would say, I mean, I see such high-level talented leaders. And I would say that the biggest thing standing in their way is often their relationship with themselves. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that made me think about writing this book, was like, wow, people are running programs that are self-destructive. I mean, what about that makes sense? You know, what about that makes sense? None of it does. And it's heartbreaking when you hear how humans talk to themselves. And the interesting thing is it impacts their relationship, because if you're hard on yourself, you're going to be hard on the people you love the most and want to hurt the least.
Yeah,
and there you're going to hurt them, and you're going to hurt yourself as a relationship deteriorates.
You have a feedback exercise that you do in the class. Can you talk about that?
We do an exercise called the Reflective Best Self exercise. And in this exercise, we ask people to collect feedback from you know, colleagues, family, friends, from the past, from the present, but not just any feedback, it's positive feedback. So it's the kind of feedback about when they showed up at their best self. And most people are very uncomfortable with this. They would so much rather ask for areas of opportunity, like the negative, you know, negative stuff. Very uncomfortable with this, which again, you can ask yourself, well, why? Like, why is it a big deal to ask for the positive, but not a big deal to ask for the negative? Already, that's already strange, isn't it? But then when they get the feedback, you know, for a lot of people, it's like reading their own eulogy and seeing what a mark they have left in people's lives that they had no idea that they were leaving. And it always breaks my heart when I think how many people are walking around feeling terrible about themselves because they're always focusing on the negative, not realizing the many ways that they've touched other people's lives and changed them for the better.
Let's talk a bit about authenticity and inauthenticity. And let's start with the negative. What happens when you live an inauthentic life, when you are hiding parts of yourself? Does that affect you mentally? Does it affect your health? Does it affect your career prospects?
Well, I think a lot of times people live an inauthentic life because they want to be accepted. They want to belong. They want to be like everyone else. But I have a question for you, Kelly. When you see someone who's being inauthentic, can you see through them? Can you see that?
100%.
100%. How do you feel around someone who's being inauthentic?
Oh, run away. I mean, people come here to learn to be their authentic selves because that's their comic voice. And the comic voice only works when you're including all the dumb stuff that you do. That's what's funny.
Right.
So, yeah. And what I have no, I mean, again, when you talk about this in the book, when you have to hide parts of yourself, you know, you are doing a disservice to yourselves in a number of ways.
You know, there's this book that I talk about. It was a best-selling book called Self-Made Man. Mm-hmm. With this woman, I'm forgetting her name of the author now, but she dressed dressed like a man, cross-dressed for a year to try and document that experience of living in a man's world. And the book is fascinating. She goes into these hyper-masculine societies, you know, from like bowling clubs to a monastery. And in the last chapter, she talks about how she loses her mind and she has a major mental health crisis. I mean, that's an extreme example, but, sure. But regardless, you know, we act a certain way because we want to fit in. And the result, as you said, Kelly, is people feel uncomfortable around someone who's, inauthentic and want to run away. So it's like the opposite is happening, right? If you think about it, like a party, right? You get to a party and there's someone who puts on a certain air. Well, they may look good and you may stare at them for a few minutes, but then there's another person who's acting goofy, maybe spilled something on themselves, are a little embarrassed, but are completely authentic. Who are you going to want to talk to? Probably that second person, because when you're around authenticity, your whole system relaxes. And there's a study on this, and I go into this in the chapter on emotions, because, you know, whenever I've asked audiences, what do you learn from society about what to do with your big, bad, negative emotions? This is a topic that's fascinating to me, because no matter how many PhDs, MDs, black belts you have, chances are you have as much formal training on what to do with your emotions as a five-year-old, right? Like, people don't have any training. Anyway, so most people, and this is kind of across cultures, with some exceptions, they'll say, well, I just kind of learned this stuff from inside, you know, keep the bottle up. Right. And if you look at the research on that, it's fascinating, because I was in a lab where we studied this at Stanford, is that when you suppress emotion, it actually gets stronger at the level of the brain. So you're actually making yourself angrier, which is probably why you're going to blow your top at some point or have migraine or passive aggressive or you name it, right? Things. But the most fascinating study I found was this. When you're suppressing emotion, it's because you're trying to maintain appearances. Like, you don't want to blow up at, like, say, your boss, right? Like, let's say I was suppressing anger right now, and I'm like, nope, I'm not feeling angry, Kelly, not me, I'm just fine, right? Uh-huh. Your heart rate increases. And your mind would not necessarily understand why, but you would start to feel the sense of, I don't feel comfortable on this person. I just kind of want to back away, get out of here. And that is because even though your brain hasn't caught on that, okay, she's suppressing, therefore I'm feeling comfortable, your physiology, your fight or flight is activated. Why? Because our instinct is that inauthenticity is threat. We see this in the animal kingdom. So let's say, have you heard of equine facilitated therapy?
Yes.
So there's a therapist and a horse, and then they work with like a child with trauma or something. So if the child comes up and is pretending not to be scared of the horse, it's like, I'm fine, I'm not scared, I'm cool, you know, and they're scared. The horse is very anxious and it's moving all over the place. But as soon as the child says, I'm scared, the horse calms down. And the horse doesn't speak English, right? But the horse's instinct is that we register inauthenticity as threat because you can't trust it. So it's really doing you a disservice. And yet I think for a lot of people, there's fear, right? Well, what if I'm myself and I don't belong? Yeah, maybe you won't belong in certain places. But, you know, what's worse, the pain of belonging in a place where you don't feel like yourself, or just being yourself and the pain of maybe not belonging everywhere? You know what I mean? Not being accepted everywhere.
Yeah, I did EMDR therapy, which was so powerful. It was so powerful in terms of sort of teaching me to listen to my body, and that my body was telling me things that, you know, I was not getting or I was fighting. And that ability to slow down your breath, just that ability to slow down your breath. And in any area where you are looking to be a peak performer, so that could be an actor, that could be a basketball player, that could be a business person, that self-regulation is hugely important. And so to understand that as a human being, you're not emotionless. So you can't like to deny it. Okay, that doesn't work. And that also doesn't mean you have to walk around sobbing all the time. It's but allowing yourself, and we just had Mike Norton on the podcast, and there's some in his Ritual Effect book, there's some great research around this idea around happiness and the ability to cycle through all the emotions. You're never going to be on a low all the time or a high all the time. It's impossible. So we need to experience these things, but that culturally is not our base setting.
Right. No. Our culture, we don't want to feel bad ever. No. And that's kind of a problem, especially in the US. I think in cultures like in China or India, there's an understanding that suffering is part of the cycle of things. Mm-hmm. But here we have this sense of if I'm not well, there's something wrong. And therefore, I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of people have a hard time withstanding not feeling well and turning to addictive behaviors to not feel. Like, okay, you don't have to be an alcoholic. You can be addicted to doom scrolling. You can be addicted to watching movies. You can be addicted to overworking. You can be addicted to over volunteering and looking saintly. Like, it doesn't matter. But what happens is at the end of the day, when you're back home, when you're done, you're feeling the same thing, only worse, because you're probably beaten up by whatever drug of choice, right? So, and that's what we're falling for. That's what I call the bound state. That is not sovereign, because you are hooking yourself to the feeling. And, you know, I'll share another personal story that's kind of, you know, that's revealing. If you remember the story where, when I was in college, I had an eating disorder where I would binge whenever I felt down, and I couldn't help it. It was kind of this addictive, impulsive thing. And, one day, and that was, I went on for a couple of years. And, one day I went to meditation class. Meditation was not popular at the time. In fact, it was considered weird. And, but I went because I had a crush on someone, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I can meet him. So I went, but it turned out it was this very strict form of Korean Zen meditation where you're sitting still and you're just sort of staring at the ground for an hour with no instruction and you can't move. So, which is like like hell for, you know, an 18 year old. So here I am doing that, thinking I'm never doing this again in my life. And when I left, you know, I felt a little more peaceful, but, you know, I was out of there. And the next day I was feeling bad again. I was feeling low, and I walked into my dorm room, and there was this old pizza that even looked gross. And I was like, great, I can binge, you know, this is what I do when I feel low. But all of a sudden, and I definitely attribute this to the meditation, is that because we know that it improves self-awareness, that all of a sudden I had this insight I'd never had before, which was, hey, you always cry after you binge. Why don't you cry first and then binge as much as you want? And I thought, okay. And I went and lay on my bed and I cried. I experienced that emotion fully. And when I was done and I got up, I didn't want to binge anymore. Oh. And that was the last day that I ever binged, that I ever used food, you know, to cope with my feelings. And I realized that it is through feeling it is healing it. Like it, you have to go through the emotion, but as adults, we can spend our entire adulthood trying to push the feeling away. Now a child will be angry for 1 or 2 minutes and then be real angry and they're going to be feeling it. And then they're done and they're playing with the person they were so mad at, right? But an adult can be angry for the rest of their lives. And that's what I would call a balanced state. And sovereignty is really learning to experience our pain. And some people get real mad at me when I say that. But I'm telling you that you're suffering more by not feeling it because you're binding yourself to it. Not that you need to have a tantrum in the, you know, in grocery store when they don't have your favorite cereal or, you know, but this idea of being able to withstand. Because emotion is energy in motion. It is moving through your body. And I think as an, you know, and actors understand this, you know, this, it is a full bodied expression of energy and it moves through you. It doesn't want to hang out. It's moving. You got to let it move though. And there are things you can do to help with that. Some of which are breathing and movement, other things, but, and creativity. But, yeah, that's one of the insights.
So you talk in the book about imprints, which sort of feels like mental bounding, or you know, and that they come from many different places and culturally. And you've had an interesting life in that you have lived from, you know, in other parts of the world that are very different. So talk a little bit about, you know, the imprint of your time in America versus imprint in, say, growing up in France.
Yeah. So imprints are kind of belief systems that we have adopted, often due to our culture or our family or our background or even trauma that we went through our history. And they are ways of thinking and perceiving the world and interpreting the world. So growing up in Paris sounds glamorous, but at least when I grew up there, it was the way that you bond with people is through negativity, through complaining. Everything's always going to hell in a handbasket. Everything is gloomy. You know, even the models in French, like ads and stuff, they're not smiling. It's like the sexy pout. You know, that's just how it is. Everything's doom and gloom, despite, you know, despite France having pretty much everything that anybody would want. But so that's how I grew up. And I always, you always feel like you're not good enough. And in school, you're graded on 20 and nobody ever gets 20 on 20. Or, you know, if you get a high grade, you get like a 16, you know, it's just very, you're always kind of focusing on the negative. And then when I came to the US, I was like, wow, you know, people don't have time for complaints here. You know, there's a much more positive attitude and the sense that you can do what you set yourself out to do. And, you know, even though you know, probably French people would think that's naive, when I moved here, I was like, wow, like I adopt this. Like this, you know, sometimes you have to enter a new cultural context and then you realize that how you've always been doing things isn't the only way or necessarily the best way. And I realized, you know what? I like this framing better. I'm going to adopt this. But then when I spent a couple years in the US, I realized, wow, people work themselves to the bone and they think they are what they do and they suffer as a consequence. And so I was like, that's interesting. And I fell for that for a while until I realized, no, this is an imprint. I'm going to deprogram. This is not working. And it's not the truth, right? What you realize is that these ways that we come to perceive our lives and ourselves are not always life supportive. So that's just one example, but imprints are also things that we get through our media. And again, living in different cultures. So after college in the US, I went to China for a couple of years and it was really fascinating because you'd open the South China Morning Post and you'd see all these positive headlines about the news. It's like everything is just peachy all the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And the other students and I would laugh about this thinking, gosh, this is so naive. But then coming back to the US and looking at the headlines here and how everything is always, you know, in gruesome detail about one heinous crime that is not the norm, but the exception, but being blown up. You know, you think, wow, like this news is conditioning us for the scare, you know, fear. And so, you know, when you talk to journalists, they'll readily tell you that that's the way you're going to click on ads. And that's how they keep you hooked, right? So being aware of your imprints allows you to step back. So here I had a really interesting conversation with a colonel in the military, in the army, who his job was to create imprints. So in other words, to brainwash the Taliban, the opposition. And that was his job. And I was like, wow, how do you go about your life? And he's like, well, he is always scanning for the intent behind any messaging coming his way. What was fascinating, I was like, well, how do you teach your kids? And he said, well, when we're in the grocery store and my child wants one of the sugary cereals, I tell them, so why do you want that? Why do you want that cereal? And the child would be like, oh, it's so fun. Look at all the colors. And there's like cute little, animals on it. And then he'll be like, okay, so why do you think that it's so colorful and has all these cute animals? Oh, because it makes you happy when you look at it. And why do you think they do that? Oh, because it makes kids happy. And like, we love little animals and love all the colors. And so why do you think that they, it goes on and on. I'm like, wow, talk about like learning how to not have your mind be conditioned by someone whose job it is to condition the minds, So it's very interesting. But another form of imprint, of course, comes from our own history and our trauma. And that's, that's something that many people are carrying. And that is absolutely real. Having worked with veterans with post-traumatic stress, you can really see how the impact of one experience can really shape your whole life. I can think of one veteran who he had a wartime experience on a bridge. And, I remember walking with him in the U.S. and turning and looking up at him and sweat pouring down his face and thinking, what's going on? And he said, I can't walk over a bridge. And, how that trauma is completely handicapping his present moment, hijacking, I should say, his present moment. And that is real. And so addressing trauma is no light matter and is necessary for us to be able to live a sovereign life in which we're not completely overtaken by our past. And some of the research that we did on a breathing practice called sky breath meditation with veterans showed that, using these breathing practices, we saw their anxiety normalize. Many of them no longer qualified as having post-traumatic stress. And the study was also run at the Palo Alto VA, was replicated, and we found that the breathing was at least as good or better than the gold standard therapy out there. So, these imprints come in many, many shapes and forms. It's through our beliefs, our politics, our religion, our family, our own life history. And some of them are very supportive of our life and others are destructive. And so sovereignty is really learning to see what they are and to dismantle those that are no longer allowing us to be free to live the life we want to live.
And what's interesting too about sovereignty, I think, is a term, it's very empowering, but one of its qualities is required vulnerability. The being open to the unknown, because it all is. And this is something that's very ingrained in improvisers because there's no script. So they have to completely, and they're playing not just with the person of the cast, they're playing with the audience and how that is all working. So you have to be very open to shift and to change and all that, which is not easy for human beings to do. So talk a bit about that sort of like wading into the unknown, because I think you talk about that as wisdom, kind of wisdom.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I made an equation for sovereignty. Sovereignty equals awareness. And everything we've been talking about so far has been about increasing our awareness, self-awareness, awareness, external awareness, plus courage, plus a full tank. So I talk about that too. When we're drained, and which can come again from imprints and other things, it's very difficult to have awareness and also to have courage. And we do need the courage and to go into the unknown. But at the same time, don't we want to live the life that we were born for? Don't we want to, do we want to live in fear? Do we want to live small? Or do we want to live as in the full expression of our gifts? Every single person, especially doing this reflective best self exercise, people realize how many gifts they're carrying around within themselves that they don't even know are changing the lives of the people around them for the better. What would happen if we could live in the full expression of those rather than in fear, rather than thinking we're not good enough, which 80% of millennials endorse with regard to almost every area of their life, by the way, which is crazy. But yes, you do need the courage. And yet, that's it. Just got to have it. Just got to do it. I mean, you know, or we can just live on our couch, just sort of go to work, watch TV. Do it again.
There's a phrase in improvisation that all our students learn, which is to see all obstacles as gifts. Yes. And that you seize on these opportunities. So when a mistake is made on stage, you're like, ah, this is great. This will give me an opportunity to make a whole other sort of choice in the moment. And you have to do that because of the situation you're in here as a maker. But if we see ourselves, because we're all makers, I mean, like, we don't walk around with scripts. I mean, we have some scripts in our head. We have some imprints and things like that. But generally speaking, this is you know, this conversation is made up. We're like, we don't know where it's going to go. Yes. So if your orientation is towards curiosity as opposed to blame and that sort of thing, wow, you just opened up, you've opened up everything.
Yes. And I do think that one thing that's important in order to be able to have both the courage and the willingness to be spontaneous and to move from a place of, like you said, curiosity and sort of acceptance of what's going on and is, I do believe that. And one of the most important things we can do is to cultivate a sovereign nervous system and mind, in the sense that practices like meditation that help you cultivate not just awareness, but centeredness can help you navigate in life in a much better way than if you were to try and do this while, you know, underslept, high on caffeine and anxious. Because then, and I'm sure that Kelly, I'd love to hear what you think, you know, when actors come on stage trying to improvise from that space, it's going to look different, right?
Yeah, that's why there's a half hour call before they even get on the stage. And in that time, there's the rituals, the preparation rituals. There's the I've got your back, whichever actor says to each other. And you know, you try to make sure people are sleeping in as much control as you have over that. And you put, yes, exactly. You can tell when someone is not in their space to be a peak performer, and vice versa. It's like the greatest magic trick you ever saw when six people are improvising beautifully on stage and the entire audience is laughing together. There's just nothing like that.
There's nothing like that. And it's interesting because when you think of athletes, right, they need to go out there and peak performance.
Yeah.
They are working hard. They are training hard and they are taking care of themselves, especially the actors that go on to have long careers. You know, I think at 20, you can pretty much burn yourself out on all ends and still be okay. That's not going to look the same at 30 and definitely not at 40. But those, you know, the like Tom Brady's, those who are performing into their 40s. Those are people who are taking such good care of themselves. Who are we not to do the same thing as we go into our lives? Now, of course, if you're running you've got three jobs that you're working and you've got five kids and you're a single mom, like that's really, really hard. Yeah. But what for everyone, even if you just have 5 minutes during the day for yourself at the end of the day when everyone's in bed, or 10 minutes in the morning before you get up, what are you choosing to do? How are you choosing to cultivate your mind and your nervous system? Again, are you just watching mindless shows? Are you just going through your phone, doing things that aren't nourishing you? Or are you taking those 5 minutes to close your eyes and be in gratitude or meditation? Or, you know, if prayer is one of your practices or whatever it is, that you're honoring yourself, you know, and you're honoring your nervous system. And that, you know, that's always the question. We all, if we look at our lives, most of us spend time during the day that we're wasting.
Yeah.
It's like, why not, even though, despite being busy, there's time that's wasted. Why not take that time and use it to nourish yourself so that you can show up at your best?
In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a thank you because story. But before we do that, let's talk about play. So improv is very much play. We don't call it play when we're selling it to corporate clients because apparently they don't want to buy that. They should be. and they are. It's just called improvisation. But you write in the book about how important play is. So talk to us about that.
It's so interesting. You know, when you look at a child and they laugh with their whole body. And think how that compares to an adult that sort of, you know, mutters out a little, ha ha, you know? And just think about what's the difference between a child. They're so 100% in their experience of life and therefore of joy and of everything that they do. They live with intensity, intense presence. And as adults, we get so consumed, you know, also because of our imprints and all the things. But we get so serious and we forget about the nature, we forget about, like you said earlier, you know, we don't know how long we have here. We forget about celebrating mm-hmm. our life, celebrating every moment with every person we get to experience. Could be a micro moment of upliftment for both people. You know, whether it's a person at the cash register or your child or your pet, you know, are you living your life with the intensity of joy? And that becomes a play. That becomes, life becomes so much more joyful. And that has a lot to do with having our mind in the present moment. A lot of times adults can't play because their mind is consumed with worries about the future and, you know, imprints from the past. And not to mention the 60,000 gigabytes of information they're taking in every day. And so there's this, you know, inability to experience real joy. And if you look at, you know, those sort of spiritual masters out there that are, you know, well-known, you know, Buddhist meditators or whoever, right? They have this joy inside of them. And it's not that they're not aware of the suffering that's going on the planet. In fact, they're probably hyper aware of it, but they are also aware of the finiteness of everything. And they know how to laugh from their belly. Play.
I love that. All right. So for guests we've had on the podcast who've already given us a yes and story, we asked for a thank you because story. Do you have one for us?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the ways in which I learned how to sort of deprogram this self-loathing conditioning in my mind was to learn to set boundaries, which I was not very good at, in fact, at all. I was even in an abusive relationship at one point. And I would go into work situations where I would have people pushing my boundaries all the time. So I was running a study and I had run it for 6 years. I had written the grants for it, raised the money for it, recruited research assistants, recruited the participants, trained the research assistants, run the study, run the statistics, written the paper. But politics in our lab were preventing me from getting it out there. It was just a lot of unhappiness in that lab. And it was just very weird. And I wanted to get the paper out there. And then a professor from another lab who was up for tenure and was needing more publications came up to me and said, "Hey, I really care about your research. It's really important to me. I want to help you get this paper out." Now I could read between the lines. Mm-hmm. He needed to have another publication, but I also needed help to get this paper out. So I said, "Okay." And he did. And he pulled some strings and we wrote the paper. I mean, he helped change little parts of the paper and we submitted it and it got accepted. And as it got, or right before it was going for publication, I get an email from him that I was expecting. "Hey, how about we be co-first authors?" Now, being first author is a big deal. Again, I had done all the work on this paper for about 6 years. Okay. And I knew this was coming and it was kind of a slimy request.
Yeah.
And I went to the director of my lab. And I said, this person is requesting this. And he said, "I have no problems with it." So here I was, a junior female scientist up against two professors who not only did not have my back, including my own mentor, who had a lot of power. And this is where my thank you. Thank you, because I decided to respond to them both with an email. And I said, "I just took my courage in both hands. Thank you for this opportunity for show my boundaries." That would be my story. So I emailed them, "I respectfully decline your request." Mm-hmm. And it worked. I had no idea it would work. But, you know, every time that we take our courage in our hands and set a boundary or do anything really, we are deprogramming ourselves from ways in which we've done things in the past. And whether or not it had worked, I had done something to cut the program, to change the neural pathways, you could think of it as. You're changing your habit. for something that was more life supportive. And since then, I've just found it so much easier to set the boundaries when I need to.
Did you see, there was a paper that Vanessa Bonds and her colleagues came out around saying no. Did you see this
paper? Which paper is that?
I forget the name of it, but the experiment was a bunch of college students, first group comes in, they say, all right, I need you to unlock your mobile, your cell phone for me. I'm going to take it out of the room and do some stuff, and then I'll bring it back. And if you don't want me to do that, it's not going to affect your grade or your pay. That's the first group. And most people in that group gave them the phones.
Oh my God.
In the second group, they gave them a script. So they said, same setup, they said, and if you don't want me to do this, just say, I would rather not. Those people said, I would rather not.
Wow.
And what I found fascinating about that, I'm like, oh, so when we're working in sort of the unknown, when you're making something out of nothing, you are improvising. But when you have boundaries, you need scripts.
Exactly. It's like you have to rehearse it in your mind. And, being able to send that email, I certainly probably spent a while trying to think about how I was going to.
I bet you did.
Yeah.
I mean, you're probably wondering about the punctuation. If I put this comma here, is that going to be thought of a certain way? Because again, and people are surprised by this. Like, you ask people for stuff, a lot of times they'll just say yes.
That's right. They will.
That's so fascinating. The book is called Sovereign: Reclaim Your Freedom, Energy, and Power in a Time of Distraction, Uncertainty, and Chaos. Emma Seppala, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It was a pleasure, Kelly. Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.